You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews with a local perspective. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and the show airs on Wednesdays, 5 o'clock after calendar, and on Sunday at 12:30. Today, we are going to be talking to David Pablo Cohn. He has written a book of short stories called 8 in 3 Weeks and Other Early Stories. He's a resident of our wonderful Quimper Peninsula, and he has a lot of interests and a lot to tell you about his life. And so I'm really excited to have him here. Welcome, Pablo.
Thanks so much.
I kind of said, he told me, most people call me Pablo. They know me by Pablo. So I'm going to stop saying David and just say Pablo.
I answer to either without distinction.
Well, let's start with kind of where you began, your early life and your career. Tell us about Silicon Valley and being a computer scientist.
I come from a family of academics, and I was also supposed to be a professor. I'm a failed academic. I applied for, I think it was 143 faculty positions over a period of 5 years. Got zero interviews even. Mm-hmm. And so fell into startups and rode 4 startups down into smoking craters. Burnt through 2 life savings, found a startup I couldn't kill. It did
it
okay.
It goes on.
It goes on.
Did you work that into your writing? Did you start writing at that point?
I've been writing most of my life. Most mm-hmm. of it has been travelogue. Actually, when I was young, I wrote songs and poetry and then just sort of drifted into narrative. After spending, I don't know how many years of my life sitting in front of a screen, typing, I had a life-changing conversation with an old friend from high school. This was sitting in the basement at a party, and I saw, you know, Beth, you know, what have you been up to? And she was an English major, and she said, well, what have you been up to, Pablo? And I said, well, you know, I got a PhD, I went to MIT, I'm your faculty.
That all sounds good.
Da, 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 you know, now I'm the head of the research labs at this startup, and I was feeling pretty good with myself, and I said, so what have you been up to, Beth? You know, feeling like, you know, I just kind of, you know, mm-hmm. I just dropped the mic there. And she said, well, you know, I ran a theater troupe for a while and it did this and did that. And, you know, now I do station personnel logistics at the South Pole. Mm. And there was like, my jaw dropped. What do you say to that? I just said, what's it like? And she got this crazy evil smile. And she said, and this is a phrase that people of our age will recognize. She said, magnificent desolation. Mm-hmm. And you know, I recognize that. It's Buzz Aldrin. And I called her on the Buzz Aldrin quote, and she said, yeah, when I was a kid, I was going to work on the moon base that we haven't built. And the South Pole is the closest I've ever been able to find. And I asked the next obvious question, which was, how do I go? 2 years later, I managed to, applying for a job to work with the Antarctic program and getting a position at the South Pole it's not as hard as being an astronaut, but it was surprisingly hard.
Yes.
And I found myself 2 years later as literally the help desk at the bottom of the world, because there is a staff of about 200 people.
I love that phrase, the help desk at the bottom of the world.
And you know, people don't realize when you talk about Antarctica, you know, people. I have friends who say, you know, oh, my brother took a cruise to the South Pole. Well, no, maybe took a cruise to the peninsula at the tip of Antarctica. You know, the South Pole is 2 miles up on an ice desert, 2,000 miles wide, you know, average temperature minus 57. It is a moon base, and we have a research station there with. Between 150 and 200 people there. And so, you know, and printers break and computers break and people, you know, can't get, you know, Windows to boot up. And so my job for 4 months during the 2010-2011 season was basically helping people fix their computers, mm-hmm. you know.
And you had time to write when you were down there as well.
I did. Mostly I was doing narrative then, but that was what got me started in fiction. Is there's actually a blog post when I go back where I found this one blog post where I said, I just thought of this thing, which would be a great story, but it's fiction and I don't write fiction and somebody should really write this story. And nobody did. Mm-hmm. And then it was about 2 or so years later that I said, well, okay, dang it. It turned into a novella. I self-published it just because I wanted it to be out there. And it's a fun story. It's a romp. It's called Heller's Tale. It's about misbehavior at the South Pole. And it's almost true.
It's almost there. Well, of course. And then there's Africa.
Yeah.
So you're involved with a foundation called the Natembeya Foundation. You want to say it again?
Sure. Natembeya. It comes from a Swahili phrase, kinatembeya ki, which I could be totally wrong. I hope I'm not. We were told expresses the phrase of walking to walk, sort of walking to we don't know where we're going. We're going to figure it out. It's used to capture sort of the East African Maasai Samburu tradition of kind of going walkabout, this spirit quest. There are a lot of situations in our life where we found ourselves when we left Silicon Valley, we had some extra money, but we don't want to get used to having this in our pocket because then we're going to start spending it. So we pushed it aside into a family foundation where we could put it towards philanthropy, but we couldn't actually buy it ourselves, buy things ourselves. And people said, well, what's the mission of your foundation? We don't know. We're going to figure this out. And so Natembeya has become a sort of a watchword in our family for we're going to figure this out as we go.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And have you written a story? Well, I know you have written a story that's beautifully set in Africa. And I'm going to ask you if you could read a little bit from it.
Sure, sure.
You can introduce it also.
Yeah. This is called Anzia Town Road, and we got involved in West Africa. Originally, I was volunteering as an international election observer with the Carter Center. That brought me to Liberia, and we found ourselves involved with some health organizations. There's one that is trying, called Last Mile Health, that's trying to get healthcare to probably half of Liberia's population that is just completely off the grid. Nobody actually, except the villages themselves, know they're there. And their way of life is rapidly changing, as cell phones come and they're wrestling with, do we preserve our traditional way of life, or, do we give up everything our ancestors had known in order to have the comforts of modern life? And that's sort of where this story came from, was it's called Anzia Town Road. And the old man had come to the side of the road to die. His daughter had gone to Zia Town a week ago on market day. Sometimes she stayed with her mother's people there overnight, sometimes longer. He didn't mind. He was fine on his own in the village, and he knew women needed others to talk to. But when she didn't return on the third day, he walked to the narrow dirt footpath through the forest, following the river to the main road. There he sat and asked passers-by whether they were going to Zia, and if they would ask after his daughter when they got there. The next morning he came again to the road and sat. Again he asked his questions, but no one had seen her. The old man had gone to Zia Town himself many times when he was younger. Back then he'd gone to drink palm wine with the other young men, to brag and to court his wife. Now Zia Town was too far, much too far for an old man to walk. Even the walk from his village to the road was hard for him. He had started early, as soon as it was warm enough, but without his daughter to make the fire and cook the porridge, it had been hard to shake off the night's chill. There was still a little dried fish and fruit. The last of the boiled rice had gone bad 2 days before, so he ate some of the fish to fill his belly and warm himself. He placed the rest, with the fruit, in his shoulder bag and started towards the road. There used to be more families here in Gabi, his brother's family, and before the war, even more than that. When Taylor's men came, they took the boys, and yes, many of the girls too, and the rest fled. His brother had always been the clever one. When they'd heard Taylor was coming, he'd burnt his own home and hid his family in the bush for a week. He hid by the bamboo on the other side of the river, where there was water and noise and it was hard to travel. The brother had told them all what to do and told them what Taylor would do when he came, but Gabi was so small. Why would a big man like Charles Taylor bother Gabi? Yes, his brother had always been the clever one, the old man thought. His boys had hidden, then come back to Gabi to grow tall and strong at their father's side. His own, they were gone. His girls, they had been taken by Taylor's men too. They left only his youngest, just walking then and weaned by his brother's wife. He called the little girl Jewel, his own wife's last gift. Things were better after the war, and then men from the mines came through. They said there was gold in Konobo, and the Chinese were paying workers to dig for it. One of the men who came was from Jewe, and the old man's brother knew him, and sent a son to go with him to see. The son sent back money, so when the rains ended, his brother's family left too. His oldest daughter returned. She had been taken by Taylor's men, but she came back after the war. She had with her a small boy she called James. The reunion had been happy and the boy thrived. The old man carried him on his shoulders and taught him songs. He showed the boy how to plant cassava, how to tap the rubber trees. Then the daughter fell ill and weakened. She grew thin and wouldn't eat. James sat at the foot of her bed while Jules sponged her sister's forehead with a wet cloth. The bush doctor from Gilegalor told her to take peppers to breathe the smoke from the leaves he brought, but it did not help, and she died early the next rainy season. James fell ill, too, soon after, and by the time the rain stopped, only the old man and Jules were left. Even before, Gabi had never been a large village, not like Bilbo City or Zia. But why should it be? They had enough. If you wanted oil or cloth, the women could walk to Zia and be back by nightfall. Even faster if someone on the trail with a motorbike gave you a ride. And Bilbo? The man couldn't think why anyone would go to Bilbo. The Germans had come and built 3 wells in Bilbo. He walked there himself 3 years ago and asked them to build one, just one, in Gabi. It took the whole morning to get to Bilbo, and he wasn't a young man, not even then. He had dressed well to meet the Germans, and he spoke well to them. He told them the history of Gabi, how they fought well in the war, how they thrived and now fell on hard times, of how many goats he had and how much better it would be to have a well for his daughter to draw from. The Germans listened and thanked him for his speech, but they said the choice was not theirs, that they had been sent by others who decided to build wells here. Could he talk to the others? It was very difficult, they said. The old man thought of how for the foreigners, simple things always seemed difficult.
You are listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and you just heard David Pablo Cohn reading from his book On Zia Town Road. That's the name of the short story. The book is called 8 and 3 Weeks, and so much is packed into those few pages. What it's like to be in a small remote village, you really painted that very well, and the complications involved in international aid and the politics, and the healthcare, and just what's happening to the people. So I loved listening to that part of the story. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. So tell us about how you gained these experiences and made it come to life for us.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. I think I've always been an experience junkie. I'm fascinated, maybe obsessed with the range of human experience out there. Just the fact that there are so many different lives in this world. And sort of once I pulled the plug on Silicon Valley and, you know, stepped out into the world of Antarctica, you know, living on a moon base, and then came back, was an election observer in Liberia, and, you know, found myself on a motorbike on, you know, on this road to Zia Town Road, stopping and talking to these people who lived there and who walked that road. It just, I don't know, the idea of sitting behind a machine and just typing away, you know, just, you know, to optimize click-throughs, just...
It opened your heart.
Yeah. You know, especially my first posting with the Antarctic Program was at the South Pole, but for the past about 5 years, I've been working on one of the research icebreakers, and the Nathaniel B. Palmer. And something that people do at sea is, you know, you sit and you look over the rail and you tell stories about places you've been. And these people, a surprising number of people on this icebreaker are actually from Port Townsend. And listening to these stories, you know, a shout out to my friends, you know, Ken and Tom, who have been boat people all their lives, and just listening to stories of, you know, salmon fishing in Alaska from Tom, and, you know, these, you know, crazy things going wrong on you know, trying to land a research team on an island. You want to capture these stories, and you're just like, you want to share this, you grab this feeling and be able to share it with other people.
So I'm also, when I looked at your card, it's got a picture of a Zeppelin with a little plane underneath. And so another one of your passions is being an instructor and a pilot of antique aircraft.
That's right.
How does that play into your writing and your life?
Well, I've been, you know, I guess I'm obsessed with a lot of things. I've been obsessed with airplanes ever since I was, before I could speak. My parents have a picture of me on moving day when I was like 4 years old, and I had cut the moving boxes into the shape of an airplane and was, you know, sitting in the airplane going, meow, meow, meow. I got my pilot's license when I was in school, and have it's been my primary way of, I don't know, blowing off steam when things get hard. Mm-hmm. And some number of years ago, I got involved with an organization called the Collings Foundation, which is a living history museum. And they're made up of volunteer pilots who barnstorm around the country for 10 months a year in World War II bombers and fighters. And there, and just talk about stories, you bring these planes out and you have these World War II veterans. They're in their 80s and 90s. They were 18-year-old kids flying over Germany or over the Pacific, getting shot at. And sitting and hearing their stories and seeing the life, the energy that comes out when they're allowed to tell their stories. It's amazing. And you understand why these people, mostly airline pilots, will, spend their 2 weeks of vacation each year flying somebody else's airplanes. One of the stories in the book is sort of tries to give a flavor of what it's like being on the road with these people who are devoting their lives to sharing the airplanes and just sort of dropping into a town for 2 or 3 days, showing people around the airplanes, trying to bring some life to this
Oshkosh,
history.
Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Oh, Oshkosh is overwhelming. No, it's
That's the only thing I've heard of.
I've flown into Oshkosh a few times, but this is, we're just, four airplanes, often small airports. I think in June, we're going to be in Port Angeles. Mm-hmm. All four planes, a B-17, the only flying original B-24 in the world, a P-51 and a B-25 Mitchell.
Oh, well, people will be interested in hearing about that and going there. There's quite a few pilots here in Port Townsend.
This is such a great flying community here.
It's kind of overshadowed by the boating community, but still a big part of who we are. Here we are.
Well, they're complimentary.
That's right. So bringing us back to the Quimper Peninsula, I'd like you to tell us about Natumbeya Northwest.
The farm.
Yes, the farm. And the former Swanson family farms.
Yes,
so
yes.
It's not just any old plot of land.
So I will admit, I married a Californian and we moved south to raise our kids. But as our youngest has gotten out, is almost out of the house, we've been moving ourselves back. And about 3 or 4 years ago, I think it was, when we started, kind of settled on Port Townsend as our new home. We're still only part-time. We started looking for like a little two-bedroom writer's cabin somewhere where I could kind of hole up and write and focus between Antarctic assignments. And we very literally stumbled across this, to most people, unknown 77-acre farm right on the edge of town. Mm-hmm. This beautiful, beautiful land that had been in the Swanson family for 3 generations. Patriarch and matriarch had passed away, and it was being sold. Most of the Swanson family still lives in the neighborhood. And I just walked out onto the farm and just went, oh, it was like, I describe it as, when you're young and you know the woman you're going to marry, she's going to be this tall and she's going to be this and this and this. And then that redhead walks into the room and everything goes, and we fell in love with the land and we met the Swansons and the Taylors and the Jacobsons and basically the descendants of the family. And we heard their stories. It was being bid on by some folks who were going to turn it. I know there were folks who wanted to make it into a vineyard. I know there was some development.
They found other land.
And we, they sort of threw down a mission statement that we wanted to, with some of our ill-gotten gains, preserve it as open land for community benefit in a way that honors its history as a family farm. And that's sort of the mission. We don't know anything about farming, but fortunately, the peninsula has these amazing kids who grew up with agriculture.
Aren't they wonderful?
Brilliant, dedicated, who are looking for land. And we basically now have 6 young folks who are helping us with the farm, planting chestnut orchards, raising goats and pigs. And we have some other friends who lost their cattle pasture out on Marrowstone. And now we have their cattle on our western pasture.
There's a story bringing the cows from Marrowstone to Discovery Road.
I didn't actually get to see the cows on the road.
I have all these pictures in my head because Pablo has a blog, and you can find it by going to natumbeya.com. .org. It's not a com,
it's
is it?
It's .com, yeah.
Oh, it is. Okay.
The blog is natumbeya.com.
Okay. And reading about his adventures on the Swanson family farm. And they're delightful, and the pictures are wonderful, too.
Oh, thank you.
I'm enjoying reading that, and that could be turned into something wonderful.
The stories there are still gestating. I think yes. Stories have to gestate for a couple of years before they turn into words.
That is true. So you're just living there part-time. Are you are you there now? It's springtime.
Yeah.
Things are happening.
Well, January, February, I'm up full-time. We finally got the well drilled and online, and we're, you know, going through the permits and trying to figure out how to rebuild the old farmhouse and...
A million projects.
Fortunately, there are these brilliant and dedicated kids who are bringing it to life for us.
That's great. Yeah. That's great. And you have a tractor.
We have a tractor. I spent Father's Day fixing our tractor. I never imagined how empowering it would be to spend Father's Day under a tractor.
Yes. And it actually looks like a pretty spiffy red, you know, not completely ancient tractor. So hopefully it'll do you proud in the coming year as you harvest hay. And what else are you planning on doing there?
Well, let's see. Well, the past couple of days.
What's your vision?
The past couple of days, we've been using the tractor to spread manure. And, you know, there are all sorts of metaphors that we're not going to literally get into.
No, it's wet now.
Yeah. But it's been a messy few days. The primary goal for the next couple of years is get more nitrogen into the soil. So get animals to eat poop. We've got Mark and Nancy Bowman who are raising goats. Mark has raised them from 1 week old, and they're like equal parts kitten, puppy, and complete mayhem.
Yeah, I know that about goats. The mayhem part, when they are these grown up goats?
They're sort of teenage goats right now, which means they're starting to get teenagery.
Okay. Well, it's always good to have teenagers around. They give us life and more interesting aspects to our lives. So we've been talking, and it's been a delight to talk to David Pablo Cohn. He's writing here in Port Townsend and all over the rest of the world. His book of short stories is called 8 in 3 Weeks, and you can find it online and in bookstores, perhaps even in our library. So yes, he says yes, so that's great. Please join us next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website, kptz.org. And while you're there, make a donation to the station. We depend on you. Thanks, Mike Schlexer, and thank you, Larry Stein, for helping with the program. And thanks all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. Please stay tuned to hear another wonderful show. More music, more talk. The music you heard today was African music from our wonderful host of Rhythm Connection, Robert Ambrose. Thanks, Robert.